use the negative thinking to protect your clients, but be able to shift to noticing the good in your environment when you want to capitalize on a relationship or promote or build connections with other people.
Welcome to Modern Business Operations, where we talk with leaders about how ops is adapting to our modern world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Modern Business Operations. My name is Sagi. I'm the CEO and founder of Tonkin. And today I have the pleasure to host Dr. Larry Richard. Hey, Larry, how are you doing?
I'm good, Sagi. Good to meet you and good to be here today.
Yes, absolutely. It's my pleasure. Well, I'll let you introduce yourself, but Larry is the author and the principal consultant and lawyer brain. He also does some very interesting psychologically related researches that I want to get into, but maybe I'll let you, you know, say it better and kind of give a good background and context for your career and what you're up to right now.
So I started in life as a lawyer at age 2. Now, I know that sounds like a joke, but in a way, it's actually the truth. I come from several generations of lawyers. My father was a lawyer, grandfather, aunts, uncles, cousins. We had a lot of lawyers in the family. So I never gave it a second thought about what my career would be. I just assumed I'm going into law. And beyond that, I assumed I'm going to be a litigator because that's what true lawyers do. And I took all of the requisite pre-law courses in college. And then I went to law school at a very good school, University of Pennsylvania. And on day one, I came home from law school feeling like I have made a massive mistake. And it didn't get any better from there. And I slogged through 3 years of law school, and it felt every day like I was kind of wasting my life. But I thought, well, maybe this is how it is. Maybe it's kind of like, you know, fraternity hazing, and you got to go through this, and then you get to the good stuff. Then I got out into practice and practiced law for 10 years. And each year, it just got worse and worse and worse. It was, by worse, I mean, it wasn't a good fit for me. Who I am and what I was doing were not nicely matched. And it became more and more obvious. I kept switching jobs every 18 months, and I tried lots of different jobs as a lawyer. None of them really fit me. And finally, after almost 10 years of this, I, you know, took some time off and did some soul searching and realized that the through line for me, for my entire career, even my entire life, was psychology. I've always been a people person. I enjoy being with people. I enjoy studying people. I enjoy understanding people. And it comes easily to me. And when I realized that, I thought, I'm going to go back and earn a PhD in psychology. And I'm going to use that experience to study the very bad experience that I've been having in this practice. I want to understand my own experience. I want to understand the lawyers in my family. And eventually I started growing very interested in understanding lawyers in general and society, because they are the largest profession in the world. There are more lawyers than any other profession.
Oh, wow.
And so it's something that has really always been a passion for me since I first had this insight.
So you then went and did psychoanalysis to your family. What did you find?
So I wouldn't put it that way, but as a matter of fact, I did ask my whole family, my parents and my sister and some of the other lawyers in the family, to complete one of the many personality assessment tools that I use. And I discovered, I should mention, I have tested since the early 90s about 25,000 lawyers or more with various personality tools. And when I tested my parents and the rest of my family, it was early in this process. But if we fast forward to today, what I've learned about lawyers, I look at their profiles and they look like classic lawyers. Even the ones who are not lawyers, it taught me that if you hang around lawyers long enough, you're going to start looking and sounding like one. So it was very helpful for me, very helpful for my father in particular. When we went over his scores, I think for the first time, he understood why I didn't like law. To him, anybody who goes to law school should love practicing law. He couldn't conceive of the idea that a person would not like being a lawyer. It was just, you know, some sort of mystery that was insoluble. And I finally, when we sat down with our respective personality scores, I think he had a really good insight about, oh, so you're wired differently. And that's true. I'm wired in ways that most lawyers are not. And that helped me understand close to 10 years that I spent knocking my head against the proverbial brick wall.
That's fascinating. I think many ways people, you know, experience a mini version of this. Obviously, in your case, everyone in your, you know, growing up in your sphere, in your ecosystem, were from a certain, you know, place. It's a little bit biblical almost, you know, everyone grew up in a certain way and you kind of go a different way. But I think even for most people don't have that, you know, the detachment from like what your parents did, you know, you have kids, I have young kids, you kind of like, for a long time, you are sort of like, you think that they're in your image and kind of like would be just like you. But if we focus on, and I have a lot of questions or a lot of kind of interesting topic out of this, because I think it's very timely with AI and everything. Well, we'll come back to that. What is, you mentioned there's a profile, like it's very clearly a lawyer. Like what, like maybe share with the audience, like what is some unique characteristic or properties of a lawyer from a personality perspective?
Well, in order to answer that, I have to give you a little bit of background first. Of all the tests that I've used over the years, there's a very high quality, I'll call it an industrial strength personality assessment tool called the Caliper Profile. It's been around for 60 years, and it's been used in dozens of countries around the world. And it measures 21 different personality traits. And when you test people on this particular tool, each of the personality traits, each of the 21 traits, you get a score that ranges from the low of 1% to a high of 99%. So one of my traits is called urgency. It means I'm very impatient. So if I finish your sentences, it's nothing personal. And high urgency people have a kind of a fast clock. They we go through, you know, we tap our toes and we're eager to get to the finish line. So what does a 99% mean? It means I am more urgent, more impatient than 99% of the representative sample. It's not the entire Caliper database. That would be unwieldy. But they have a database within that large sample that's mainly professionals, so lawyers, doctors, engineers, executives in companies. And compared to that database, I'm more urgent than 99% of them, if you can believe that. When I first got my scores back, I brought them home and I showed my wife. I said, can you believe I got a 99 in urgency? And she said, thank goodness, I've been trying to tell you this for years. Now we see it on an actual printout. Anyway, so test scores range from 1 to 99. But when you take an aggregate, usually an occupational group, like let's say 100,000 lawyers or 100,000 accountants, you're going to see the individual scores are going to vary all across the board, but the highs and lows cancel out and you get a classic bell curve where the average is close to 50%. And sometimes it's going to be exactly 50, sometimes it's going to be 40-something or 50-something, but it's highly unlikely that the average score for any one of the 21 traits would end up being below 40 or above 60. You'd expect every one of the 21 traits to have an average between those goalposts. And that's true for just about every occupation except for lawyers. And lawyers, 7 of the 21 traits, the average is below 40 or above 60. This is just unheard of. And that data has been consistent. This is the 31st year that I've been doing this research. And these traits, 6 of these traits, have been outliers, atypical from the start. And they haven't changed, even though the professions changed. There wasn't even much technology in the early 90s when I started this. Now, technology is the central, you know, challenge that we have. The kinds of problems we face, the size of law firms is different, the geographical spread, the kinds of problems that they solve, everything's different, but the personalities of people who go into law has been rock steady for 31 straight years. And I find that fascinating. The other thing is, of these 21 traits, like I said, seven of them are atypical. So what are these seven atypical traits that make lawyers so different from the public? Number one, extraordinarily high scores on skepticism. Instead of a 50% average, the average skepticism for lawyers is 90%. And of course, when I tell this to most lawyers, they're like, really? Right. So, you know, and they, sometimes they're joking, sometimes they're not. The second one is lawyers have incredible autonomy. They do not want other people to tell them what to do. Now, most people don't like being told what to do, but lawyers make it into an art form. I mean, they're like, do not tell me what to do, or we're going to arm wrestle over this. So number three, lawyers are high in abstract reasoning. They like analyzing and problem solving and ultimately mental stimulation. And a lot of them go into law because of that very reason. Law gives the opportunity to use your intellect, to use your high IQ. And so it's very common for lawyers. Number four, urgency, the trait I mentioned earlier. Lawyers are off the chart in urgency. They're very impatient. And that makes sense because I mainly work with large law firms, with the Am Law 100, the top largest 100 law firms around the world. And the clients of these large law firms are usually businesses that have very, very sophisticated, challenging problems that need resolution yesterday. And so it stands to reason that people who are dispositionally more impatient, that want to get to the finish line, would be more likely to end up in a profession that requires solving problems yesterday. So urgency fits the profession. Now, those are the traits that are above the average. What are the ones that are below the average, below 40%? The first one is sociability. Lawyers, and people often think I'm talking about extroversion, but I'm not. That's a separate trait. Sociability refers to a quality where people who score high tend to be very comfortable with disclosing things and with vulnerability. If I bare my soul a bit in meeting a new person, it invites that new person to do the same with me. And the vulnerability deepens connection and encourages us to be authentic with each other. And that's the hallmark of deep social connections that people have, which research increasingly shows is one of the most important things for a healthy, well-lived life. Low-scoring people on sociability are just the opposite. They're very private. They're guarded. They don't want to reveal anything. So they try to keep the conversation at a very superficial level and talk about very safe topics like the news or politics or art or society or the weather, but not anything personal. Well, the average, of course, is 50% for the public. The average for lawyers is 12.5%.
Wow.
Now, I have it on good authority, Sagi, that a potted palm is 8%. So just for purposes of comparison, I mean, lawyers are very, very private. Next, lawyers are very low in a personality trait called resilience. Now, we all hear the word resilience, and it usually refers to recovering from trauma or hardship. But as a personality trait, resilience refers to recovering from interpersonal challenges like criticism or making a mistake or someone forgets your birthday or you're left out of a meeting, things like that. And high resilience people, they just don't really worry about criticism and rejection. You know, somebody criticizes them, they're like, yeah, whatever, and they move on. But a low resilience person is very insecure, very thin-skinned, easily wounded, defensive. They'll ruminate about a criticism for days or weeks even. They try to anticipate when they might get criticized and sidestep those situations so it doesn't happen. So it's a very, very important trait. Well, this trait is special, so special that the American Bar Association asked me to write a book about it which we're almost done with, and that should be released at the end of the year. And it's called Thin Skin: Why Lawyers Are So Low in Resilience and the New Science That Can Help. And the idea is that this trait differs from all the others I've mentioned in the following way. When I say lawyers are atypical, what I mean is the average is just lower or higher than the average for the public, for the non-lawyers. And it's basically, think of it as a bell curve that's moved to the left or moved to the right. But with resilience, it's not only moved to the lower end, but the whole curve has squished, it's deformed. It's what we call a skewed distribution. 90% of lawyers are in the bottom half of the resilience scale, 9 out of 10. And when I tell this to groups of lawyers, I tell them, if you feel bad hearing that statistic, it illustrates the very trait that we're talking about. It's like, oh no, we're low in resilience. Oh no, it's so.
And if it takes you to recover from it a few weeks, then right. That yet again.
That's right. And so we're worried about what people will think of us. We're worried about whether we are, you know, can believe in ourselves. We're worried about all kinds of things because of low resilience. And it's such a pervasive trait because it's so widespread in the profession that it's been fascinating to me over these years. And that's, I think, why it came to the onto the radar screen of the American Bar Association. So it's a very, very significant trait because it affects lots and lots of things that we otherwise, you know, have kind of conventional wisdom about lawyers. Almost all of those conventional wisdom statements can be explained by understanding that they're low in resilience. We'll get into maybe a little of that in a bit. And those six traits that I just mentioned have been outliers from the start and very stable over time. The seventh trait is a newer trait. It was always low, but never low enough to be called an outlier. But that changed about 5-10 years ago, and it's empathy, particularly a type of empathy called cognitive empathy, which is perspective taking or stepping into the shoes of another person. You know, what is it like for you? Or how is my comment or my action going to land in your world? Or what's important to you? People who score high in cognitive empathy naturally take into account the people that they're interacting with. Low-scoring people look through their own filter, their own lens, and they don't usually take into account the impact it will have on others or what others need and that sort of thing. Doesn't mean they can't do it. It's not a measurement of skill. It's just that they prioritize the world as they see it, and they deprioritize the world as others see it. And lawyers have been dropping, so they were close to being outliers on the low end, but never quite made it. But like I said, 5 to 10 years, I've started seeing scores dropping. And what I've since discovered is it's not just lawyers. This is a pattern that has been happening the world over, mainly among millennials, people born 1982 and more recently. And for millennials, in law, in any other occupation, in any other country, empathy has been declining precipitously. There's one study that says that empathy for this cohort has declined 40% compared to the previous generation. 40%, that's huge. And people always ask, why is this happening? And no one knows for sure, but the smart money is on technology and social media. And the idea is that when people grow up today, and a lot of schools around the world have tightened the economic belt and have cut back on playground time or even playgrounds altogether. And it used to be when kids played in the playground in the early years of school, that's where they would learn perspective taking. That's where they learn cognitive empathy. You'd say something nasty to a friend of yours, and you'd see their face cave in, and you'd say, oh, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings, and you'd make a course correction. But now, if you grow up using texting as your main communication medium, you don't get to see facial expressions, and you don't have any emotional information. So the two most important pieces of feedback that help build empathy are completely absent in the growing up years of kids. So no wonder that they grow up with lower empathy scores.
I have additional take on that. I think it's definitely, as you know, research aside, just like perception, right, or perspective on this. Obviously, texting, like you said, is it very different than face to face or even voice, right? When you can kind of hear people pause and whatnot. I do think that also there's a big difference in the last 15, 20 years and 20 year prior and the 20 year prior to that of how you both, how would you celebrate wins? And then how do you kind of like treat failures? What do you define as success? And I was nodding my head pretty hard when you were talking about the empathy dropping, because it's very clear to see it. Running a company, you kind of like interacting with a lot of different people, customers, clients, employees, new hires, everything. And so you kind of see that you have some sort of a filter too over the years. And even in the last 10 years, I've seen a difference. But my point I was kind of going at is, if everyone gets a trophy at the end, that changes the dynamic of people. If everyone is a star, right, which is really kind of like where the pop culture went to, everyone is unique, everyone is a star, everyone can do anything, then you are in a place where your point of view of the world, the way you perceive the world, to your point of the like of the opposite of empathy, you've been indulged this entire time that that's a valid point of view, and maybe it's even the best point of view, because whatever you think is your future, then that's yours, you know, and you can, and it's just everything is possible. And I'm not, again, of course this is like a fine line there, right? Like you want to encourage people to kind of dream and like go, you do whatever, it came from a lot of good place, but I think the result of it is really like something to also kind of put as part of it. And of course social media with the echo chambers, right, also kind of influence that same thing. The way I look at the world is continually being encouraged as the number one thing, as the for you page, you know, when you go into the app, it's like, it's all about you. It's all about how you see things. It's all about what you care about. Then obviously you're going to be lacking empathy, because what do I need to care about? What do you think? You know, but if you lose in the game and only the number one player or whatever is getting the trophy and everyone else is losing, then what you did is definitely not good enough for that specific task. So you need to do some introspect and think differently. You know what I mean? And so on and so forth.
This episode is brought to you by Tonkin. Tonkin is the operating system for business operations, providing businesses with the building blocks to orchestrate any process with no code or change management required. Contact us at Tonkin.com to learn how you can build complex processes fast.
I think you're right. I think you're tapping into something important that's in addition to the points I made. There is this idea of we're kind of creating a generation of narcissists. We're creating people where everybody gets an award. Everybody is thinking about me, me, me. And if I'm thinking about me, 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 who am I not thinking about? You, you, you. So yeah, I think there's some of that as well. You're right.
It's all around you, right? It's like, and again, it's really easy to follow the breadcrumbs of why we got here, right? When you realize that the internet was starting as a shopping mall, everything makes sense. When you realize it's like, that's all it was. It's like, instead of having like all the different places for you to get information, let's put everything in the same place. I'm not talking about when in universities use it. I'm talking about when it started to be commercialized, right? It's all about how do we bring people into the shopping mall? And then from then you realize the wave of it, right? Wait. Who wouldn't want to go to a shopping mall that is literally made for them, that only has the type of stores that they care about, that only sells the type of thing that they care about, right? That's quote unquote should be the best experience. But of course, it removes the most important part of human being, which is curiosity and seeing what out there and kind of having being exposed to new ideas and different things that you haven't thought about. But of course, like, again, this is kind of where it comes down to, because when you were talking, I'm just thinking about a social feed, and I'm thinking about the only two options is either for you, which is recommendations for things that will sound the way you like to think about things, or things that you already followed directly and said, I'm going to curate the things I want to look at, just for the things that makes me feel good about, you know, the situation.
So you remind me of an old joke that is very apropos here, which goes like this. Enough talking about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think about me?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
It kind of sums it up.
Exactly right. I think it's a big problem, though. I think it's also bad timing in many ways. When, you know, coming from, you know, the technology angle and AI and, you know, a lot of folks, when it comes to law in general, practicing law that I've interviewed and talked to, the question of, you know, what is the future of that business look like? How does it going to look like, you know, next year, in 5 years, in 10 years and beyond, when you have a lot of work that is still very much manual and requires knowledge and type of tasks that lawyers consider part of their craft, that is not something that, you know, they have to do anymore, or maybe not today, but like coming up pretty soon, but also today they're already. So some departments already went through that transition, but law is kind of like would face it heads on because it's so much around the written word today. And a lot of that is gonna shift. So those personalities traits and sort of like how do you define yourself, I think will play a massive role in any, not to use the same word, but any role, any job that is gonna face this. From your deep, deep understanding of the personalities, where do you think they stand as a profession with regard to that change that is coming?
Well, I think we're in for some pain coming down the pike. And what I mean by that is lawyers, because of their low resilience, are likely to look for the problems with AI. They're going to focus more on what's bad about it than what's good about it. I can see both sides of that coin. So there are some advantages to AI in the sense that it can help lawyers do research lightning fast instead of taking weeks or months to build some sort of a complex brief. AI can do it in seconds. Now, of course, there's some accuracy problems these days, but that will be fixed, I'm sure, as the technology improves. So it gives lawyers a tool because lawyers, you know, traffic in information. Their expertise is what makes them worth spending money because they have expertise that other people don't. And it's both content expertise and process expertise. And AI is quickly learning both of those types of expertise. So in a way, it's making their job easier, but it's creating stress for the following reason. The pessimistic, skeptical lawyers see these advances in AI, and what they say to themselves is, oh my God, I'm going to be put out of a job. AI is going to take over my job. The more optimistic among them instead think this way. Great, AI is going to take all of the boring, repetitive, tedious work, and now I get to do the more sophisticated one-off work. It's going to raise the game for me and give me more interesting work. And I think they're both right. The challenge is when AI starts doing all of the boring work, it's also putting lots of lawyers out of work because there's not enough of the bespoke work, the more challenging work, for the same number of people. So yeah, there are people who are going to increase the sophistication level of the work that they do because they no longer have to do the boring stuff, but there are going to be fewer of them. So it's very possible that a lot of people who have a law degree are going to be waiting tables or driving taxis if that doesn't get taken over by AI itself. So, you know, that's an oversimplification, but there is a lot of anxiety in the profession. When I talk to my clients these days, I'm hearing a lot of anxiety about AI. And there is a small cohort of people who are super excited about all of the potential, and they're trying to, you know, go down that path and to look for the, you know, the new ideas that are coming down the pike and be part of these new ways of practicing law. The profession as a whole, you know, we hear associates, the younger lawyers in large law firms, complaining or worrying that, gee, it's going to take my job. AI is going to take my job. But if you think about it, associates are the people that are in training to become partners of the future. And if you eliminate associates, in a very short time, you won't have any partners to, you know, to fill the slots that are opening. So you can't get rid of associates. I can see that they might be reduced in number, and there might be a different algorithm for how we charge our clients, because you can't charge by the billable hour when it only takes you 30 seconds to do something that used to take hours. So it's going to put some pressure on the billable hour, which has people talked about the billable hour being, you know, the demise of the billable hour coming since 1975. It hasn't gone away yet, but this might be the one thing that does make it go away.
Look, I think this is my personal opinion. I'm curious to hear what you think, but I'm not of the camp that thinks that jobs are actually going to go away. Some people might lose their job, but not because the job went away, because the job changed and they weren't able to change with it. I do think that there's a precedence to this. I just think that the technology now with AI did cross a certain threshold, that before that threshold, the type of work that lawyers were doing were just not accessible with AI, so it just didn't fill it. That's why the billable hour didn't go away. It went away on other places. You don't pay engineers billable hours anymore. You know, I mean, it used to be at the beginning, everything was you pay someone for the work they do on an hourly basis. The more sophisticated, quote unquote, the work is, the more it kind of like detached from the idea of an hour. But unless you have something else that can do the hourly task, then you would continue to kind of bill by it. So I think that will come with it. But I think, you know, with the time we have left, where I really want to focus on kind of how do you help, you know, those top 100 law firms, and from an organization perspective, but also on an individual perspective, if someone comes to you for advice on from law school or later in their career with this wave coming, with that change coming, what can they do in order to prepare themselves better for that shift?
So my clients are mainly the leadership teams, the senior leadership teams in large law firms and in corporate legal departments. I don't generally work directly with individuals as clients. Although once I'm working with a firm, sometimes I might coach an individual as a result of what I'm doing with the leadership team. But it's very unusual that an individual will call me, and I'm not usually set up for that type of work. The kinds of things that I am focusing on these days more than anything else is driven by the environment that we're in, which is change and uncertainty are rising at an exponential level. Everybody's feeling it. Everybody's stressed out. Everybody is there. Our heads are spinning. We're all facing this world out there that just is accelerating at such a pace that we can barely plan. We can barely have a moment of peace ourselves before some device is drawing on our attention. And so it's hurting all of us in a number of ways, but the most important one is something that I think all of your listeners beyond law, people in the business world, people in other professions, they're going to relate to this as well as people in the legal profession. And that is, human brains are affected by this rapidly accelerating level of change and uncertainty in some very negative ways that we can cope with. But a lot of people don't realize that there are solutions. So here's the problem. Our brains all have a circuitry. I call it simply the threat sensing circuit. And the purpose of that circuitry is to scan the environment 24/7 and mentally tap us on the shoulder if the circuitry detects any type of a threat to our well-being or to our survival. It's a very, you know, primeval mechanism designed to keep us alive and safe. And the main mechanism that this threat circuitry uses is change. So when change starts accelerating, the threat circuit in our brain starts going, uh-oh, what's happening? Am I at risk? Is there a threat in my midst? In the, 10,000 years ago, when this circuitry probably developed, the threat might have been a noise outside your cave. And when you hear the noise and you see, oh, it's a predator of some sort, a saber-toothed tiger or whatever, you take action and you either fight, flight, or freeze. So hopefully you get to live another day and the crisis is over in a few minutes and you're done. Your heart rate returns to normal. Your breathing returns to normal. You return to whatever you were thinking or talking about before the crisis occurred. That type of episodic change is the main thing that our threat circuitry was designed for. But that's not what we're largely responding to today. Today, we're responding to large, open-ended, unending, ongoing threats that are very, very severe threats that could kill us or hurt us severely that we don't have control over. And our circuitry is just stuck in the on position. So let me name a few just to illustrate what I'm talking about. Climate change and, these wild, dramatic storms of different types that can kill thousands of people suddenly without warning. COVID and whatever successor viruses are coming down the pike that we may not have some solution to save us from. Wars that are hot wars with, military conflict that are going on right now around the world that could explode into a nuclear holocaust at any minute. Political polarization that is creating a we versus they environment where people feel personally threatened by the potential for future harm, and on and on and on. I don't have to list all of them. We all know these scenarios. My point is our threat circuits are operating overtime, and that's having a very important, two really important problems. One is it's creating higher levels of stress than we're usually skilled at coping with, and that's causing some distress. But secondly, and this is a subtle little thing, but it's so important to understand, the threat circuitry calls on the intellect of the brain. The prefrontal cortex is the technical name for it. It calls on the intellect periodically when it senses threat because it has some intellectual questions that the PFC is good at answering. Those are questions like, what kind of a threat am I detecting here? What can I do about this threat? How seriously can this threat hurt me, et cetera? Those are intellectual questions. While the threat circuitry is drawing on the intellectual horsepower of your brain, you don't have that portion of the horsepower to work with. So if you're a lawyer and you make your living through your intellect, every day you get up and your threat circuit is compromising your capacity to think like a lawyer. It's borrowing some of this brain power for used by the threat circuitry, and it doesn't tap you on the shoulder and say, excuse me, Sugi, I'm borrowing 10% of your horsepower, 25% of your mental horse. It just takes it. And people walk around feeling distracted and irritable and exhausted and depleted, and they don't know why. There's no roadmap for this. And so the first step here is understanding, what's the nature of change? What does it do to us? How is it affecting individuals? How is it affecting people in leadership positions? How is it affecting entire organizations, teams, units within companies and law firms? If you don't understand the effect that all of this change is having psychologically, you're going to be at the mercy of these changes without any tools for producing a remedy. Luckily, psychology has developed a number of tools, things that can mitigate the effects of what I've just described and put you in a better position to cope so that we don't go through our days feeling mentally exhausted and distracted. The first one is recognize change when it's happening and be in charge of your own attention. These external events grab at our attention. That's what our brain circuit is designed to do. Oh, there's a threat. I'll turn my attention to the threat. once you recognize that you're not going to get killed by something on CNN, you can then take back control and direct your attention to something that's more positive, more stable, more familiar. So, simple example, my wife and I have a beautiful garden out back. We consciously choose to go out in that garden a lot because in the garden, we're free from all of the stressors that I've just been describing. And that garden, while it has, you know, changes that are evolving over time, you know, they go through the seasons, the plants change. The basic essence of the garden doesn't change. It doesn't become a bulldozer. It doesn't become, you know, a McDonald's meal. It's a garden. It's going to stay a garden, and we can count on it. Every time we go out there, there's our garden. And it is one of those things that provides an element of stability. And there are lots of other ways that people can direct their attention to things that are stable and unchanging. And that kind of reduces some of the threat to the amygdala, the organ in your brain that is the, kind of the sentry for threat. The second thing that people can do is focus their attention on the positive. Most of us in general, most people in general, have what's called a negativity bias. We pay more attention to threats and problems than to good things and to opportunities. But lawyers overdo this because of our skepticism. We're trained to think negatively. So we have more of a negativity bias than the general public. And what you want to do is you don't want to end that because it's actually quite useful for practicing law. So what you want to do is be able to be more flexible, more adaptable. Use the negative thinking to protect your clients, but be able to shift to noticing the good in your environment when you want to capitalize on a relationship or promote or build connections with other people. And that's something that's like a muscle. We have to relearn how to use that positivity muscle. And if we don't, we're going to alienate others. We're going to increase our stress level and so forth. There's even been a number of research studies in the past 10 years that have highlighted this for lawyers and have shown that we are much more exposed than people in general to stress. We're more vulnerable to loneliness and to depression and ultimately to suicide. We're more likely to suffer sleep disturbances. We're more at risk for substance abuse. None of these have to be this way, but the tendency of us to think negatively and to, you know, not prioritize relationships and to be guarded and some of the other things that I mentioned, they just make it more challenging for lawyers to be healthy, to experience well-being. And again, that's something that is kind of the path of least resistance, but it doesn't have to be that way. There are things that we can do to remedy that. And in the book that we're writing, we cover that.
Well, this is all fascinating. I think we got to touch a lot of things, and I think we can talk for five more hours if we let. But I took something that I think very simple and easy to do for everyone is stop watching CNN and go sit in the garden and watch the flowers. I think that will make everyone slightly more sane. But jokes aside, I think it's fascinating. I think there's a lot of incredibly important points that we were able to touch on. But I think in general, if people want to follow you so they can get a hands on the book when it comes out, where they can find you, is it LinkedIn or X, or where can they follow you?
I'm on LinkedIn. I canceled my Twitter account when it became X, so I'm not on there anymore. But I'm on LinkedIn, and people can also go directly to my website at lawyerbrain.com, and my contact info is on there.
Very good. Dr. Larry Richard. Larry, thank you so much. That was a great conversation, and I really appreciate all the insights.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Sagi.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Modern Business Operations. You can see the show notes and all of the resources mentioned on today's episode at tonkin.com/mbopod. Thank you for listening, and be sure to subscribe for updates on future episodes. And if you're interested in staying up to date on the latest in business operations technology, head over to tonkin.com.